be talking on Lenin, Lenin's notion of state power and his ideas on state governance. And then we'll let the audience make the connections between the talks. I'm sure there's some good ones. So I'll be focusing on two texts. One is State and Revolution, and the other one is Can the Bolsheviks Retain State Power? And these are two sister texts written almost simultaneously on the eve of October 1917. State and Revolution is perhaps the most well-known of Lenin's works on the state, and scholars usually emphasize Lenin's argument on the violent takeover of the state, as well as the argument that the state needs to be, or the state's coercive instruments needs to be used to establish the so-called dictatorship of the proletariat. And so the argument goes that these notions of the state take us directly to Stalin's authoritarian repressive apparatus. Upon closer reading, however, these texts appear much more complex, and they're bound with they abound with certain unresolved tensions. Some of them are, for example, between democracy and dictatorship, terms that are used very often very synonymously in the texts, between state centralism and self-organized grassroots forms of governance, between revolutionary takeover and social transformation. And so on, and I would like to explore some of these tensions and contradictions here. So in this paper, I'm going to focus on these two texts with two points in mind. First, I would like to bring to the forefront Lenin's preoccupation with direct democracy and grassroots organization. So these are crucial elements in both texts, which have remained suppressed in most interpretations. In State and Revolution, Lenin asserts that Bolshevik state control is only possible in a symbiotic configuration with the Soviets. These are the peasants, workers, and soldiers' councils by embracing their flexible grassroots self-regulating apparatus, as he calls them, of direct democracy. Actually, and the second text, Can the Bolsheviks Retain State Power, written in the same context. It's written during Provisional Government Russia, facing the imminent possibility of a socialist revolution. Lenin writes it to discourage the arguments of skeptics who question the Bolsheviks' ability, in case they capture power, to govern the state. So it is also written to radicalize the Soviets against Mensheviks and bourgeois attempts at co-opting and minimizing the legitimacy and visibility of the Bolsheviks in a very complicated dual power situation. But this is a side point. Most importantly, it asserts that, again, Bolshevik state control is only possible in a symbiotic configuration with the Soviets. In other words, if it embraces the flexible self-regulating mechanisms of these participatory forms. In these writings, as well as in his post-1917 work, Lenin's attention is preoccupied with the question how much to retain from, the existing institutions of the state, how much to abolish, and what alternative forms of authority and social organization would emerge in its place. And this takes me to my second point, which is that both texts are concerned with preserving and developing the state's productive mechanisms of governance, meant to gradually replace the coercive and juridical institutions of the state. And this is what he calls the withering away of the state, Lenin's famous withering away of the state, and I'm interested in figuring out what exactly does he mean by saying the state will wither away. What is at stake in this withering away of the state? So autonomy, freedom, and self-empowerment for Lenin, it turns out, mean the ability to own and govern collectively one's means of subsistence, of course. But they're also practices that are inevitably tied to the state's ability to bring into being empowered subjects through productive forms of subordination. I focus on Lenin's attempt to imagine a mode of state governance that would replace the repressive mechanisms of the state machine, this is the standing army and the police, with a different, already existing set of institutions, a set that is involved in the normative production of a particular kind of a subject, an emancipated socialist subject. So, as we know, perhaps most of us recently, there have been some very valuable efforts to reclaim the theoretical and political legacy of Lenin's work and to reclaim the revolutionary agency of that work. I'm assuming we're familiar with the work of Žižek and others who have done some really interesting and valuable revisionist interpretations, reinterpretations around Lenin. And yet some of that work makes similar decades-old assumptions about Lenin's notion of the state, arguing that Lenin's conception of the state somehow remains a general rather than a historical category throughout his work, and that Lenin's state is ultimately founded on the premise that it organizes social relations through oppression and remains an inherently coercive mechanism of domination. For example, Žižek writes, the key premise of state and revolution is that you cannot fully democratize the state. The state as such, in its very notion, is a dictatorship of one class over another. And insofar as we still dwell within the domain of the state, we're legitimately entitled to exercise full violent terror, since within this domain, every democracy is a fake. In other words, Lenin's state, or Lenin's notion of a state, remains a mechanism of class domination throughout, and this ontology of the state will find its full expression in the Stalinist repressions. And so repeat the point for Žižek, this ontological gesture expresses itself fully under Stalin, and he argues that this is the case both with the bad Lenin of party elitism in the earlier works, such as What is to Be Done, and the later, quote unquote, good Lenin of state and revolution. The argument continues that this moment inevitably spells the failure of any attempts to redeem Lenin, even partially from having a stake in the Stalinist outcome. And I'm going to quote him again. The element of truth is that you cannot separate the unique constellation which enabled the revolutionary takeover in October 1917 from its later Stalinist turn in its aftermath. And he calls this internal juncture the real Leninist strategy. Leninist tragedy. A closer look at the text, however, shows that revolutionary action, as Lenin imagined it, has more ambiguous and complicated relationship to violence and rupture, and indicates that he's far from indulging in utopian illusions about the revolutionary project. On the one hand, Lenin considers the liberal state, which has emerged historically as the political outcome of the capitalist organization of property and the means of production, to be a major and a sort of inevitable element in class domination, class reproduction. So he asserts against the Mensheviks that only a rupture, a revolutionary takeover of the state can eliminate capitalist exploitation, and I'm sure this argument is familiar. In the heart of its composition, the liberal state reinscribes an unequal and exploitative social order. Thus, if class inequality is to change, the bourgeois state needs to be appropriated violently so that it can be rejected in its entirety. So the state needs to be smashed, in his words. On the other hand, however, Lenin is equally critical of anarchist doctrines that invest all hopes in the singular and final act of abolishing the state machine. Again, state machine, these are his words. He opposes anarchists who assume that abolishing the state will eradicate all social oppression overnight. So for him, such views remain outright utopian, completely blind to the historical dimensions of social transformation. Framing the revolutionary question in terms of either violent action or carefully steered reform misses the possibility of understanding the revolutionary task as an intricate historical process that requires both. The revolution is both a rupture and a slow process of social transformation, conjoined in a complex temporal dynamic ultimately seeking to eradicate all repressive forms of state control and replace them with alternative forms of governance and subject production. The same with can the Bolsheviks retain state power. It makes the argument for replacing the standing army and the police with a different, already existing set of institutions, one that embraces the industrial mode of production while adopting some grassroots models of self-governance. Here is what a long quote from Can the Bolsheviks Retain State Power? In addition to the chiefly oppressive apparatus, the standing army, the police, and the bureaucracy, the modern state possesses an apparatus which has extremely close connections with the banks and the syndicates, an apparatus which performs an enormous amount of accounting and registration work. This apparatus must not and should not be smashed. It must be wrested from the control of the capitalists. The capitalists and the wires they pull must be cut off, lopped off, chopped away from this apparatus. It must be subordinated to the proletarian Soviets. It must be expanded, made more comprehensive and nationwide. In other words, the capitalist system has provided the social infrastructure at the level of, and the level of literacy that would enable anyone to perform the regulating function of the state. People would not need to acquire specialized knowledge to enhance the efficiency of the social body. Rather, every person would be schooled and gradually accustomed to performing their bureaucratic duties. Thus, while giving rise to a modern state bureaucracy and the inequalities generated by its privileges, the capitalist mode of production has also provided a way out of it. It contains the instruments for its own overcoming and the conditions for a radically new mode of social organization. Such a slow cultivation of social practice, and I quote again, will lead of itself to the gradual withering away of all bureaucracy, to the gradual creation of an order without inverted commas, an order bearing no similarity to wage slavery, an order under which the functions of control and accounting becoming more and more simple will be performed by each in turn, will then become a habit and will finally die out as the special functions of a special section of the population. And this is what's extremely curious about this text, is that such gradual habituation will lead eventually to sort of this collective and in fact total subjectivation. It would eventually, I quote again, become universal, general and popular, and there will be no getting away from it. There will be nowhere to go. The whole society will have become a single office and a single factory with equality of labor and pay. A totalizing gesture clearly structures this argument and this kind of thinking, one that involves a uniformly coherent social body, a very homogeneous social fabric, and also one that is defined by a sort of a monistic or singular entity or paradigm. And these are some of the most problematic aspects of his work. Nevertheless, it stands that image of a homogeneous social totality as it is regulated by singular, all-encompassing apparatus of production, distribution, and governance stands in clear tension with his insistence that the socialist model is possible only if control over the apparatuses of the modern state are handed over to the very young but powerful self-governing peasant and worker councils. The Soviets or the Soviets, well, empowering the latter's horizontal and grassroots models of direct democracy. And what is at stake in this sort of in sort of tension is the question. But some may say also that there's not necessarily a contradiction between forms of autonomous self-governance and the totalizing approaches of productive state governance mechanisms. And if this is the case, then perhaps we're dealing with a certain insufficiency in Lenin's theoretical formulations. His work on the state nevertheless makes an effort to articulate a circularity of power, and that's the most interesting element, that circularity of power that renders the coercive and juridical institutions of the state all but unnecessary. It picks up the opposition between capital and labor as a starting point to formulate an alternative practice of governance and a form of power that aspires to eradicate oppositions between the state and the social, between majority and minority, between oppressed and oppressors, democracy and dictatorship, and to imagine a practice of governance where violence and coercive control would be unnecessary, a social order that would make resistance unthinkable in some way. So what Foucault, some 50 years later, articulated in the form of critique of the liberal state in his writings on governmentality, Lenin grasped as a vision of alternative state power and a possibility for alternative social governance dormant in the capitalist mode of production. So how to wrestle that from capitalism or for the liberal capitalist state and transform it, like imbue it with socially positive energy was the question. And a new formulation of autonomy emerges here. There's that notion that of autonomy that recognizes the radical dependency of the subject, where the subject's agency can never circulate outside a certain mode of subordination. And because Lenin's freedom is always already a category carrying an element of corporeality with itself, an emancipatory project is imaginable only if it recognizes human practice as subordinate to concrete forms of social organization. And I'll stop here.